Hi everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their work, the lessons they've learned, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Melissa Sweet, illustrator, author, and master Maine naturalist. Being an illustrator requires taking risks. They're often scary, and therefore avoided. But what would it look like if you did take a risk, and it worked? As Melissa says, if not now, when? Among other topics, Melissa takes us through the convoluted beginning of her children's book career. We talk about why it's a good idea for illustrators to care just a little bit less about their work, and Melissa explains why, when it comes to working with color, all you need is a color wheel and a compliment. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Yeah, I read that like your favorite weather is something like 68 degrees, a warm southern breeze, but it only occurs 3 days out of the year in Maine. Is that true?
That's pretty much true. That is true.
Yeah.
But yet we are determined to stay here. If we didn't love winter, why would we be here? So we like to talk about it, but we talk about the weather incessantly. So there you have it.
I do too. And it got to a point where it made its way into our nightly routine, you know, so the kids will go to bed and then my wife and I would, you know, get a glass of wine and which we never finished, by the way. We would never finish a glass of wine. We were like, let's go outside. Let's go on the porch and drink wine and listen to the birds. And we're like, all right. And every night, that's what we do. Even when it's cold, we just put on our coats on, put a hat on,
sure,
and go outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we take like four sips of wine and we look at each other and we're like, all right, it's bedtime. But I got into the habit of going like, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow? And, you know, it's like, hey, babe, it's going to be 67 and sunny tomorrow. And then on Thursday, it's going to rain. And it got to the point where it just sort of was like, okay, at first it was like, yeah, that's nice. And then one night I just was like, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow? And I looked up at my wife and she just looked at me like, are you that guy now? Are you the guy just, you know, like, you know, old man talking about the weather? Is that you? Kind of.
Yep.
Kind of.
Hopefully you don't pull open your phone, which is what my husband does, and gives me the readout, because I could look too, but I don't really care that much. I'm willing to be surprised also.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have become those people for sure. Mm-hmm. And I hear you on the wine and bedtime. God, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
And I have no excuse. I don't have little kids anymore. So yeah. Oh, well.
Yep.
Well, I give you credit. I have no idea the editing process for something like this. I imagine it's like an art form that you get really good at. I admire it.
Melissa, it actually, you know, and this is something that ties into your process. I'm a collage artist. Really not by choice, honestly. It just kind of happened. Someone introduced me to Romare Bearden when I was in college. It just totally changed the trajectory of how I thought I'd be an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that editing a podcast is very much the same process. You kind of have to allow for it to dictate to you what it wants to be, the answers.
Yes.
And a lot like collage, you know, like, you know this better than most. You cut something up, you look at it, your brain kind of tells you like, yeah, that works, that doesn't work. And you just sort of allow for the mistakes and you allow for sort of the flow to kind of help guide you as the artist. Whereas I feel like with maybe digital painting, or not so much watercolor painting, but just all those kinds of processes, you're the one who's taking the lead. And
yes.
Anyway, editing is very much the same, I find.
Even though it's audio, so that's really interesting. It's not something I anyone ever said to me before. It's like editing a piece of art.
Exactly.
And especially collage is a good analogy.
It's an interesting process. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, maybe all art is a matter of editing.
Yeah. From what I gathered, you began your children's book career in 1986. Is that true?
Yes, 1986 is when I was first published.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say before that, there was a convoluted journey to get to the publishing house. and meeting with art directors. So it was something I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to school for illustration. I didn't know anybody directly who had been published. So when you're young and you don't need too much, you can chart a course and it can be all over the map. And finally you get there and it didn't even seem hard, if you know what I mean.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed that there was a gap, or at least I couldn't find information between when you were published as a children's book creator and when you graduated from the Kansas City Art Institute. And I was trying to track, like, okay, I know when you were born and mm-hmm. I know when you started your children's book career, you were 30.
Exactly.
So yeah. When did you graduate from Kansas City?
Well, I didn't graduate from Kansas City.
Oh, okay.
I have a really eclectic education. I went to a 2-year school out of high school.
Okay.
And then I went to Kansas City Art Institute for their foundations program. I think that was 77 or 78.
Okay.
So now we have quite a few years before I got published.
Right.
And honestly, I thought, how am I going to make my living as an artist? And my brother had just graduated from a culinary school. We went to his graduation and the tables were full of carved ice sculptures and radish rosettes and you name it. And I'm like, oh, I would really like to make those. So I attempted to go to cooking school. In the meantime, just got a job in restaurants. And that led me to illustrating a cookbook for one of the restaurants I was working at. From there, I said, I really prefer drawing and painting to being in a restaurant. Then I just put on my freelancing badge and said, I'm freelancing. And I had no idea what that meant, but I just was in Boston where I took classes in calligraphy, the book arts, really heavy, great book art community there, making one-of-a-kind limited edition bound books. Mm-hmm. So I really learned a lot about making books, and that helped me understand the marriage of text and imagery and pacing and just how to put a book together.
Right.
It was really great training before I got published. So I was pretty happy doing lettering for a menu or a logo, which I had no training in whatsoever.
Huh.
But I guess that bravado of youth is that I think I can do that. Well, I have rent to pay, so I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah, I noticed. I mean, there's a lot of typography in your illustration. And I mean, by the time you and I crossed paths when we worked together on that Beatrix Potter book, you know, obviously there's a ton of typography in the art you supplied for that book. I just assumed you had graphic design education.
No, not in the least. When I began, quote unquote, freelancing, it was a time when type was put down by hand.
Yeah.
And I learned to do that. Not well, by the way, but I could get to it. And I really learned lettering by taking classes in hand lettering, which was very, very traditional hand lettering. And I joined something called the Lettering Arts Guild of Boston. These were hardcore lettering artists, from everything from sign painters to people who did certificates for, you know, the Bishop of Boston or something.
Right.
Really fine calligraphy. It's akin to having a classical music training and then saying, no, I'm going to go play jazz every night. I learned it and then wandered. But yeah. I do love it. I try to hand letter something in all my books for sure.
You know what's funny about that book that you and I worked on? For folks listening, it's called The Celebration of Beatrix Potter. I worked with 30-plus illustrators, and we all basically, you know, commemorated the genius and wonder of Beatrix Potter. The brief was, I don't remember exactly how I worded the brief for each illustrator, but it was basically something like, what is it about Beatrix Potter that's important to you, and can you write something about her and illustrate a piece supporting the text? And I have to look at the book again. I think I have a copy in my house somewhere. Every illustrator chose a story and a character to write about and illustrate. Not you. You focused on Potter, not on a character or a story. You dug up a line from one of her journals and illustrated that. had some art, had some typography in it. Since you picked her and not a story or a character, I put your entry into the book first.
Yes, and I really appreciated that. I didn't take that lightly. I knew that was a conscious choice, and thank you for that, by the way.
Of course. My pleasure.
Yeah. I thought of her first and foremost as a naturalist, and she was.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she was a citizen scientist before that word. She was really a naturalist in the richest sense and truest sense. She was outside painting and collecting and bringing mammals in and watching their behavior. Mm-hmm. And she had that moment about the lichen discovery, so that there was a symbiotic relationship between fungi and mm-hmm. algae. I hope I'm saying this right. If not, we'll correct it. But
somebody will email.
Somebody will. Yes, thank you. And mm-hmm. please do, because we want to get it right.
Right.
But it was her process that.
Wait, are you referring to the pronunciation or to what she did?
What she did.
Oh, no, master's thesis on her. So far, so good.
Oh, no. Oh, brother, we could talk a long time about David Spotter then.
Don't get me started.
So when I look at her work, I think about that part of her and her process. And maybe that's true for all of us as illustrators, that we have this life mm-hmm. outside of our workday or what we're interested in really colors our work. That was true for Beatrix Potter. Mm-hmm. She was a force to be reckoned with. And first of all, I want to know, how the heck did she, what did she observe that she came up with that thesis? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. That's really detailed, microscopic work to see what's changing and how things are interacting. But also, she couldn't present that paper to the scientists. She had to have a man do it. So
I think it was her uncle.
Oh, it was her uncle.
Yeah.
Hooray. Okay, at least it was her uncle. Somebody that cared deeply about her thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, hopefully, like a family friend or something. I'm pretty sure it was her uncle. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, the paper was presented mercifully. But today, of course, as a scientist or naturalist, she would have been listened to. People have a much more open ear
for
very diverse group of people working in that field.
Right.
It was big. So you can see she's so much more than Peter Rabbit.
Oh, yeah. Well, my master's thesis was called More Than a Bunny Lady.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Because that's what that's what people refer to her as.
The Bunny Lady.
And obviously she wasn't that. My details could be a little foggy here, but I'm pretty sure that paper wasn't presented. It was going to be, and then she said, actually, never mind.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to look back, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
That I did not know.
Yeah.
But her discovery remains
true.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, that's why, I mean, she's hands down my favorite illustrator. There's it's not even close.
And just let's mention that her whole legacy was funneled into all the money she made, and she cared so deeply about the natural world.
Yep.
She set aside all that land.
Yep.
That, like, wow, talk about a legacy.
I know.
Never mind the books.
Way ahead of her time. Way ahead of her time.
Yeah. Thank you, Beatrix.
Anna, really. Mm-hmm. but anyway, so this is not the Beatrix Potter episode. This is the Melissa Sweet episode.
Okay.
I was looking at your artwork from the Pinky and Rec series, those mm-hmm. ready-to-reads that were written by James Howe. And I then looked at one of your more recent picture books, Cecilia Planted a Garden. Speaking of lichen and fungi and stuff, mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say your style, quote, style, I hate that word, style has evolved. It seems like the longer your children's book career gets, the more abstract, the more experimental, the more serendipitous, the more fearless your decision-making becomes. Is that a fair assessment?
Very fair. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Those first books, I felt like, of course, I was getting my toe in the water.
Right.
But I have taken classes from, always.
Right.
From the minute I finished at Kansas City and onward, because there were so many things I wanted to learn how to do. I'm positive that every one of those things that I did pushed me artistically, gave me more tools, more ways of looking at the world, more dissection. How did somebody do that? I want to do that too. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. But also, there's a sense that if not now, when? If I'm not going to let loose now, when? So that every book has that feeling. So I work in an herbarium once a month where we are taking pressed plants and we're putting them on paper and we are making them accessible for researchers. And there's a lot of really wonderful women in there. It's all women for some reason. And she said to me,
I'd love to do that if I lived. So what, Portland, Rockland, Maine?
Well, actually, I'm in Portland, and that it's the Coastal Maine Botanical Garden. So they're developing their herbarium.
All right. When's the next one? Sunday? I'll be there.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'll take a flight.
Yep. It's great. And so there's a woman doing these botanicals with us. Mm-hmm. I said something about my next book and that I didn't write it. I wish I had written it, but I didn't. So moving on, she said, well, make it your own. Just do exactly what you want to do to represent her in your way. And I thought, oh, gosh, thanks. Yes, of course that's what I should do. don't cry over spilt milk. Just make it your own.
Right.
That happens. I'm pretty sure that happens within the beginning of each book as I settle into what it is I'm going to make for each book. Mm-hmm. My hunch is, again, I'm bolder. Because there's no time to waste, especially if the book deserves it. So my latest book, it just came out this week, is How to Write a Poem by Kwame Alexander and Deanna Nikaido. Nice. As a work of fiction, that could be anything. And sometimes that's harder than working on nonfiction.
Right.
But what do I love? Hand lettering, a beautifully designed page, bringing in characters in a different way. All the things that I do in every book, it's just an opportunity to let loose. If this is the last work of fiction that I do, and I hope it isn't, I come from that point of view that let loose.
Right.
That's my attitude.
Exactly.
And then, of course, there's time to edit.
Yeah, that's a pretty common piece of advice I share with illustrators that I talk to, that I work with on a day-to-day basis. A lot of it is I think fearless actually was a good way of describing it, because fear is what keeps them back from letting go. They're very tight. They're good. They can draw, they can paint. But the tightness, which I think comes from fear, holds them back. So the advice is always like, just do some exercises, do some scribbles on a crappy notebook. Just let it go. Just draw however you want to draw. And let's see what that looks like. And inevitably, those drawings break, like it's almost like cracking the surface of something, and then all of a sudden the next handful of pieces, finished pieces that they create, have a little bit more energy to them. It's not like all of a sudden it's a total problem solve. You know, there's still work to be done, but you can see the difference, and especially with characters, especially with the energy and movement of their characters.
Yes. And do you think that's a function of doing it by hand as opposed to putting the book together on computer, whether or not they do the art that way? That, do you think that getting away from the computer is the key and not worrying about it?
Yes, I do. I tell them, use a Bic pen, use a crayon, use like a crappy, almost dried out marker, just something that isn't special and nice and pretty. And I think the computer subconsciously, maybe even consciously, kind of like, is that nice and fancy and pretty expensive brush that you're using? So like your brush strokes have to have a certain quality to them. You know, I was talking to Carter Goodrich on a previous episode. He referred to these materials as humble materials. If you use humble materials, you can let it go. You can be more free and be a little bit more fearless because you don't really care as much.
I would concur. As someone who doesn't work on the computer at all for my art, it's 100% by hand.
Right.
I send it to the publisher to be scanned. I can't imagine doing it otherwise because I don't want 10,000 colors. To me, it's all about the editing of materials and what speaks to me about this particular project.
Right.
But that's not to say that I live without the computer. Of course not. It's not to say, it's just a... it's a different way of making. And I never got good at the computer end of it.
And look, I'm sure there are people listening who work digitally who are far freer digitally than they are traditionally because of that, maybe that reason. Because it's like, well, it's a pencil or pen on paper. It's tangible. So that maybe creates a mental block for them. Whereas with digital, they can just kind of freely draw and paint. And if they don't like it, who cares? It's just pixels. They can always erase it. They can always create a new piece. It's not a waste of paper or waste of materials. It's to each their own, to each definitely their own.
Definitely. And if you understand how to make art that way well, it doesn't matter how you're making art. I think what you were trained in, and there's plenty of books I can't tell. So bravo. It's a learning curve for those of us who learn traditionally. It's not better. There's no such thing as better or worse. If the marriage of words and images, it doesn't matter what the tools and materials are to me.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Do you look at your old work and think, yeah, that's still me?
That is such a good question, because I definitely see myself in my old work and how I use materials, how I think about creating a page or the design of the book has taken leaps and bounds just for the fact of having done it for so many decades.
Right.
You get better at something by practice. It is a practice.
Sure.
First and foremost, I look at that stuff. Do I cringe? I think it was a stepping stone getting to where I am, and I don't think about it too much. Do I want to keep working that way? Not in the least. I wouldn't do this if I had to work the way I worked when I began, because you morph and get better and get different, have different interests and ways of working and want to just try so many different things. Mm-hmm. It's possible that my penchant for and passion for taking a lot of classes, which I still do, is all about that materials and kind of a physical way of working really appeals to me. And that is imperative to my work.
Have you found your artistic identity, or are you still searching for it?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I was just speaking to a young illustrator, and we were talking about, what did she call it? Imposter syndrome, she was talking about. And I said, every book has that. You never feel like this one nailed it. So it's a practice to me. Mm-hmm. Everything I'm doing in my life points to this book right now. Sure, my skill set has grown, but I still approach these books with some trepidation. Oh, brother, am I going to be able to pull this one off?
You earned Caldecott honors for A River of Words and The Right Word, both written by Jen Bryant.
Correct.
Which call was more surprising?
Oh, wow. Oh, A River of Words completely.
Why?
That first came one? Out of, well, it came out of the blue. At that time, I had a lot of acknowledgement. I mean, starred reviews were, if you got a starred review, you thought you nailed it. Like, all right, you got this. But it coincided with this project I was doing with my local library, where we were making books from old books. And that was really freeing. So I was completely intimidated by William Carlos Williams. And I hadn't worked with the publisher Erdmans before. They were super nice. I felt I had a lot of, what's the word I want? I felt a weight to do a really good job with William Carlos Williams. Mm-hmm. In fact, my neighbor said to me, my neighbor who's a wonderful writer, photographer, he said, I really like William Carlos Williams. Do a good job. And I thought, oh God. No pressure there. So there was this moment though, with the intersection of working on this project of it was an altered book project for my library. That's what we called it, altered book. And what was up for me artistically was William Carlos Williams. So I began to paint on old book jackets. And that for me was so freeing, because I'm not starting with a piece of white paper. And I felt like I had, I don't know, I felt like I liken it to taking a walk in the woods and suddenly the path was filled with pine needles. And it just changed how everything looked and felt. Also, yeah. William Carlos Williams really swung out with his poetry. Mm-hmm. He was a doctor and he began writing this poetry that was really different from anybody else. And so I thought, oh, this is so great. This is so different for me. It felt looser to start with these forms rather than a piece of white paper.
Right.
So I knew the call was coming in that day. And I remember saying to my husband at breakfast, there's no evidence that this book will get it. What I know is I swung out and I love working on this project. So let the chips fall where they may. I had done a lot of books by that point. And sure enough, I get to my studio. It's like 8:30 in the morning and the call came in. So that day was shot. I just and just couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it.
I can't even imagine what it would be feel like. I don't know if I ever won. I never will, because I just, that's beside the point. But hypothetically, if I ever got that call, I think for the rest of the day, I probably would just do a bunch of stuff that I always wanted to do. Like I would just,
yeah.
I don't know what I would do. I would just go out, go to like my favorite restaurant and have like the best breakfast of my life. And then, I don't know, go take a walk and then come back
yes.
and watch like all of the Star Wars movies and like play with my kids and just have like a super blast of a day. I think that's probably
yeah.
what I would do.
Yeah. Just let that, joyful adrenaline
yep.
encompass your bloodstream and have a day.
And have a day. Just, exactly.
And have a day. And, that is kind of what I did. I don't remember. Look, you know, computers. What was that? What year was that?
2009.
Thank you. 2009. This is going to make me sound ancient, but I mean, but I didn't have a laptop. When did I get a laptop? I don't even remember
last
when
week.
We started. Pretty much feelings like that, actually. So I didn't even know people were going to email me to say congratulations. So
oh my gosh.
I pretty much did that. I remember I lived in a little town and I took my dog for a walk. I kind of had a day and a really good cup of coffee
mm-hmm.
and
oh,
I talked
yeah.
to a few people. I talked yep. to my family. So eventually I got back to my computer, but it's a very surreal day. And you are right. Rather than being in all the accolades, just enjoy being alive and that happened. I mean, that sounds so quaint, but I really yep. feel that a walk in the woods is way, way, way the way to respond to news like that. It's all going to be there when you get back.
Yeah.
Just take it in. Yeah. Yeah,
I probably go to my favorite plant nursery and just
yeah.
buy like a few more plants than I would normally buy because of, you know, mm-hmm. they're
totally
expensive and stuff, and then plant them and
go to a bookstore.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
totally buy whatever you want.
Chill in my hammock for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Spark up the
yeah.
fire pit and just like have another cup of coffee by the fire pit. I mean, there would just be like so many fun little, and see that why do we need a Caldecott to do that? All that. That all sounds great. I might do that tomorrow.
Can I just say something sure. about that book in general? I felt very privileged to be working on a book by William Carlos Williams. I didn't know his work so well, but of course I did a deep dive on him.
Right.
And I felt a weight to do it well, but it didn't really matter how it ended. For me, artistically, it was really a breakthrough to use materials this way. And
yep.
I'll never trade that for anything.
That brings to mind this idea that if you don't care about the end product, not that you don't care, but if you don't focus as much on the end product, if you focus more on what it is that you're doing, the creative process, don't worry about the end product. Don't worry that it's a portfolio piece or not. Focus on the making of it. If you make good choices, good decisions with that, I feel like the end product will take care of itself. And that's what it sounds like happened with this book. You weren't so concerned about like, okay, well, is this going to win an award? Am I going to get a starred review? You were really focused on the subject matter and you allow that to guide you. And good things happened.
Yes, I could not agree more. I wish I just had a tape recorder for that because
I am recording this.
Okay, good. Well, there you go. Okay, we got this under wraps. And It's the swinging out with each project, taking a risk with each project and saying, what do I really want to do here? What do I really want to do? Not what is going to satisfy everybody I'm working with.
Yeah.
That's kind of where the juice starts happening.
I'm going to play a little devil's advocate here. It's just a more authentic way to approach being a children's book illustrator and writer.
Okay.
However, it does sound a little bit like, well, I mean, if you have the financial support to do that, or if you have the time to do that, or if you have the opportunity to do that, then yes, do that. But very few illustrators, I find, have all three of those things, either time, money, or opportunity. And it's not easy to swing out, to take chances, to like fully embrace your own artistic identity, especially early on.
Okay, so there's a caveat. I would say that what you just said early on may be a caveat, because one may be focusing on just the building blocks of creating a book, which there is. There, you know, there's dummies and there's pacing and there's all those things that a book needs to have. And artistically, you have a style that works and is something a group of people have said, this is the illustrator for this project. We love this work. We see it as a great marriage of words and images. But I don't want to push back exactly. But how do we keep moving forward as artists? What is it? What's keeping us from swinging out? What do you think about that?
Well, there's a very common piece of advice, you know, do what you love and create art however you want to create it. However, when we're talking about commercial art, illustration, 100% of that piece isn't entirely your own. There is a very decent chunk of that piece that belongs to the client, you know, not in terms of rights, but in terms of like, this is what we want. Here is the brief. So, you know, there's a fear maybe that if you do kind of take a chance and go a different direction or, you know, express the subject matter visually in a way that maybe that client hasn't quite seen, that the client might push back on you and say, well, no, this isn't what we wanted. I just feel like fear of losing opportunity. Maybe that's a short version of that answer.
Okay. All right. It's interesting to hear your point of view from having worked as a art director for a publisher.
Right.
No one has ever let me in on, well, we didn't really like something like you were our fourth choice, but I know that's true. I know you were our fourth choice of illustrator, but you did a great job. Thank you very much. Or they weren't happy and no one's ever going to say that. That's true. I mean, I can get that. But maybe there's a moment in people's careers, and maybe it's early on and maybe it's not, where they desperately want to try something different. And it doesn't work for this book. But is there a way to, well, let me just say this. I don't want to question what anybody's doing. Mm-hmm. I would say for me, when I swung out and said, because I got to the point of, I would say I get to a point of frustration. Like, this is not working. I don't love this. I love this story. I love the subject matter. I love the person we're writing about. But it's just not, I just can't get there. I don't know what I'm doing. When I get to that point, the only thing to do is to do a piece for me. Like, I don't know, I have any plan of showing this to anybody, but let's just say Balloons Over Broadway. I worked for years on that book, 3 years at least, going places, researching, coming back. How the heck can I show this amazing puppeteer who invented the Macy's Parade balloons? How do you show that in a picture book? So there's a moment in every book that I'm getting to what the art is going to look like. There's a lot of sketches, there's a lot of research, mm-hmm. and maybe I go somewhere, and then I get to the point where I have to create it. And it may take 1 or 100 pieces until I say, oh, to hell with it. This is how I want to do it, and this is how I'm going to do it. I don't know what their reaction is going to be, but I can't live with myself unless I do it this way. This is how I see it.
Right.
And I would say that either the people I work for are hugely gracious and they don't say, oh my God, I can't believe she did it that way. But, or they say, whoa, this isn't what we expected from her. This isn't why we hired her, but this looks amazing. Let's run with it. So what am I trying to say is that I get so frustrated sometimes that I have to let loose and do it the way I see it.
Right.
It may not be a huge transition from the way I work. It's just something about the way I designed the page or something about the book that I switched for me intellectually and physically. Yeah. The art just shifts.
Another biography you did was Some Writer about E.B. White.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when it made it onto the New York Times bestseller list, did sales of the book spike? Like, this is sort of like ties into the Caldecott Honor thing, you know, like your life kind of changes and then it kind of doesn't.
Right.
Did anything significant happen for the book or for you?
That's a great question. Of course, there's a spike in sales for a brief period of time. And I had never had a book on the New York Times bestseller list. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've had one since. And so that lasted a very short period of time. I don't know if it was 1, 2, 3 weeks. I don't actually remember. Somebody can tell us, and somebody maybe will. But
who is this somebody? We keep referring to as somebody who's going to emailing us angrily. All of your facts are wrong.
Yeah, right.
Which, by the way, after 200 plus episodes, has not happened yet.
Okay,
and
good.
I'm knocking on wood right now just to
for
sure
a short period of time, away. It was on that list and it was exhilarating. That was not something I expected. I had a lot of great attention up, a couple of Caldecott honors,
right.
And there's people, we think sometimes when it comes to awards, mm-hmm. maybe we're in the running. Maybe we are. Wouldn't that be amazing? It's a dangerous path to think about
totally
that.
Totally agree.
Before the call comes in, mm-hmm. the more, and in fact, I would say if you're expecting the call, be sure you're not, this is what I would do, be sure you're not at home. Just go have your day. Do something amazing and come back and go to work. Because the call might have come in and it might not have come in. And mm-hmm. there's no reason to focus on it. It's just like, you gotta, what do I want to say? You go back to work.
And I think that's why it's so important to have a routine.
Yeah.
Everybody to each their own, man. If people listening are like, I don't have a routine. It works fine for me. Fantastic. I'm serious. I'm happy for you. Me, and I think most creatives, I think a routine is so important for that reason, because illustration, especially illustration, is so ebb and flow. It is so up and down, peaks and valleys, mostly valleys. And so a routine is the stabilizing force that will help, maybe not ensure, maybe ensure is too strong of a word, but like ensure longevity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The studio practice, whatever that is for people, every day at the same time, once in a while, whatever it is where the juice is. That is where life is.
Absolutely.
And those awards and acknowledgments couldn't be nicer. Everybody deserves and should, I hope, gets to experience that. But honestly, it's the practice.
Yeah.
That is what life is worth living for. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yep. I read that you like to use every color on the color wheel. But when I look at your work, I think, no, she doesn't. Maybe across your 100 plus books, you've used every single color on the color wheel. But when I look at your palettes, they are complementary with what I think is a pretty clear hierarchical composition. In other words, it looks like there's a plan. So what is your relationship with color?
Wow. I learned color from Robert Spellman. We called him Spellman. I hope that's not I hope he doesn't mind me referring to him that way. For some reason, we called him Spellman. And he, to my eye, is a brilliant, brilliant painter. But he was head of Naropa Institute, and maybe he still is. He lives in Colorado. And
I had a
heck
of a vocabulary.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He did.
I had to. You laid up a dad joke. I had to spike it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I knew his wife because we were both in the Lettering Arts Guild in Boston. Mm-hmm. So once I got pretty good at lettering, I proposed my work, and I was in the Lettering Arts Guild with some really amazing lettering artists and calligraphers. Mm-hmm. And one of them's husband was this painter, Robert Spellman, and I loved his work. And I remember calling him and saying, can you teach me about color? So this is indicative of the way I've always kind of flying by the seat of my pants. I like Spellman's color. Teach me what you're thinking about. And I was just a kid. I probably wasn't even 30 years old yet, but I went to him 10 times and he did this very simple exercise on complementary colors. And I still have the worksheets where I worked with orange and blue. And how many hundreds of ways can I get to orange and blue? At a certain point, he said, you know, I have to tell you, this is the whole shtick. You know, use complementary colors to darken something. You have a blue sky. Think about putting a little orange in there. How would that feel? Mm. That was my training in color. There's nothing really to it. You darken with a complementary color, or there's so much in that wheel. There's everything's in that wheel. What more do you need? So that's why I can't really work on computer that way. I kind of have to find the color. Yep. by painting and seeing something.
Right.
So does that make sense?
Totally. You said your favorite color is fuchsia. Is that true?
Oh, that is so true. It's unbearably true. I mean, my house isn't filled with neon pink or anything, but I always
like
see
the story.
Right. I think it surprises me whenever I think to myself, oh, maybe it just needs a little more pink. That's kind of what, and I think, oh, that really nailed it. And geez, it's as if I invented it every day. It's like fuchsia.
Yeah.
But it's complementary. I just want to say this. It's complementary to green, which I use a lot. Mm-hmm. So green and fuchsia, shades of pink are basically green and red. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I was taught by Spellman.
Sure, sure. My family and I were having dinner in this town near us, but it's called Chesapeake City in Maryland. The restaurant was called Chesapeake Inn and Marina.
Okay.
Anyway, my kids started playing this game in which they were attributing personalities to color. And we determined that black is the sexiest color. Dark red is the most untrustworthy. I said Kelly Green is the most trustworthy, and no one agreed with me, which is crazy to me because, yes, that's true. And sky blue was the kindest. What's fuchsia?
Wow. That's a great question. What an interesting game.
Oh, it's such a fun game. Highly recommend playing that with your family.
I would have liked that. Fuchsia. Sassy.
Yeah.
It's a totally sassy color.
I was thinking fun. I was thinking the most fun.
Okay, fun. Fun with an attitude, though, wouldn't you say?
Definitely.
Yeah, like how dare I be this pink? Yeah, but go for it.
Or like, I'm going to be this pink and I don't care. Not that you're going to have to like it. I don't care if you like it. I'm going to be this pink and
yeah, that's
deal
the
with
sassy
it.
Part. I mm-hmm. like that a lot. But I'm looking at my bookshelf as we were speaking. And when I think of fuchsia, there isn't a color on one of these spines that would not be improved with a bit of fuchsia. That's
fuchsia.
What I'm looking at.
Yep.
A little fuchsia, yeah. Okay.
You know, it's another fun color game. I used to play this with my kids are a little older now. They're in their teens. But when they were really little, like 5 or 6, we would play this game where I would say, close your eyes. And they would close their eyes. And I would say a color, red, orange. And the more interesting the game, like the longer the game got, I would say like neon orange or neon green. But in the beginning, it's just like black, red, blue. And I'd say, close your eyes. And then I would say a color, blue. And then I would say, okay, now open your eyes and look around and quickly tell me everything that's blue. And they would look around and be like, oh my gosh, that's blue. There's blue. Because what your brain is, what you're doing is you close your eyes and you think of a color. you're sort of like training your brain to hyper-focus on that color. And the minute you open your eyes, and I think any listener, try this.
Yes.
Pause the podcast, close your eyes, and think of the craziest color you can think of, and then open your eyes and look around, and I will all but guarantee you will find that color.
That is a good game.
It's a fun game.
I like that game. I like that game a lot. Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, that's a fun way to train your eye, like a scavenger hunt for a cool font or a sans serif font or something.
It's a good card trip game.
Yeah, that is a good card trip game. You don't need anything to do it.
Nope.
Just your eyes and mouth.
Just your eyes.
That's a good game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
So let's stop playing games. And there are, illustrators listening to our conversation who, after they finish playing the color game, will go back and to their desk, to their dining room table, to their studio, and get to work. What would be one piece of advice that you would want to share with them? Or what would be one last thing that you would want to say to them directly?
Well, I'll be honest. As you were speaking, and I let that nanosecond happen after you stopped speaking, I would say take a risk. That's easy for me to say, but what would that look like for any one of us ever to take a risk, to put two colors together that are uncomfortable or that you really love and you always want to use those in a book or take a class that you always wanted to take, or everyone answers that for themselves. Mm-hmm. When that happens, like a baby step, like a risk is a baby step every day or all day long, something unexpected can happen and you can go with it. It's just a freshness, I think, that is really makes doing this work worth doing. It's bringing something fresh into it all the time.
To learn more about Melissa and her books, visit melissasweet.net. If you find value in this podcast, please consider supporting it as a patron. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you can receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, access to dozens of patron-only episodes we call extra credit, and more. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.